This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Now, the rise of China as both an economic and military powerhouse has spurred countries in the region to look closely at their ties with what was once known as the Middle Kingdom. For many here in Southeast Asia, dealing with China is something done with almost a mixture of anticipation and unease, made worse by a volatile balancing act with the other superpower in the picture, the US. So with COVID-19 and new political developments threatening to once again rewrite the world order as we knew it, I'm speaking this morning with Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow, Southeast Asia's China Challenge. Murray, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
The book that you've recently published, it's an example of also how circumstances have changed very rapidly over the past year. But of course, let's start with the biggest, most recent news that the US presidential election has been called by media outlets for former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, how is this going to affect the balance of power with China here in Southeast Asia?
Well, I think one thing that Biden made clear during the election campaign is that many of the policies toward China that the Trump administration had introduced would likely continue. There's a growing consensus in the U.S. that China has, you know, taken advantage of the U.S., has stolen intellectual property rights, has forced companies to transfer their technology to China. And there's also a growing frustration about China's behavior in the South China Sea. It's very aggressive behavior toward other claimants like Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. So I think we're going to see some continuation of the pressure on China. However, I think Biden is generally a little less sharp-elbowed than is Trump. And I think, you know, he will look for ways to engage China in various ways, such as climate change, for example. He wants to re-engage the Paris Agreement and is looking to engage with other powers on climate. And so that will require cooperating with China. He will also likely look to China to cooperate on Iran's nuclear proliferation program, which the U.S. and China and Europe had already cooperated on. So I think it'll be pressure on China, but I don't know that he will get rid of tariffs anytime soon. It might take a while, but it'll really depend on whether China wants to negotiate with him as well.
What is your sense of the Chinese government's reaction to this news then, to kind of give us a picture of how China might react to a Biden administration?
Well, they are waiting to see, for obviously, but they agree roughly with what I said. They have the comments that I've heard out of China suggest that China does not think that they're going to go back to the good old days, let's say even early President Obama or late President George W. Bush, that it's going to be a tougher slog. That they are much more competitors now than they were before, and so it's going to they anticipate that that Biden will be tougher on them than he might have been during the Obama administration when he was vice president.
All right. Now, you, along with others, have also written about the possible motivations behind China's increasing involvement in Southeast Asia. So, to which a mixture of the need to stand up to perceived challenges, as well as a sense of perhaps opportunism. So, what kind of opportunities may China find now in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic? Because at least economically, they are so far one of the few countries that is projected to charge any kind of positive growth this year. As a result, might we see them strengthening their political and economic hegemony in this region?
I mean, that is certainly possible. They are going to grow much more than any other major economy, that's for sure. And they have played such a key role in driving the economic growth in Southeast Asia also. So did the U.S., of course. But China has played a major role in the last 10 or 15 years in pulling a lot of the economies up by their bootstraps. They've also become an increasingly important investor. They're investing in things like infrastructure. They've also become a very important source of tourists as China sends literally millions, maybe I can't remember what the figure was in 2019, but something pushing 35, 40 million for sure, which is a major driver for services in the economy. So I think countries will look to China, but there is also, of course, some anxiety about, for example, in the South China Sea, China and its Coast Guard have been putting a lot of pressure on Vietnam, the Philippines, and Malaysia on doing searching for hydrocarbons and developing them. So there's that obviously, if they would put a lot of pressure on Malaysia on hydrocarbons, which with Petronas being a major player in providing revenue to the government, that would, of course, create some anxiety as well.
And I suppose this raises the question of why there seems to be such a distinction between the tack that China takes on an economic front. So over the past few years, it definitely seems as if China has taken almost a charm offensive towards countries in the region. And you juxtapose that against its positioning in the South China Sea, for example. Why the dichotomy when it comes to how it addresses its neighbors within the region?
Yeah, I think certainly as China rises, it has an increasing number of avenues, vehicles that it uses to engage Southeast Asia on. So it's engaged in economic cooperation, soft power like culture, education. But then as it's growing, it also has to start to project more hard power, and that includes threats in the South China Sea, some military sales cut even to Malaysia for naval vessels, tanks to Thailand. And then it also is involved in military exchanges, like doing increasing numbers of joint exercises with Southeast Asian countries.
Mm. And there's also, of course, on a soft power front, the matter of vaccines, right? Because Malaysia is one of the countries as well that is supposedly going to be a priority recipient of any Chinese vaccine. So will vaccine diplomacy be another arrow in China's quiver going forward?
Well, that's a good question. We'll have to see. China has certainly used it up front to say that it will provide vaccines to certain countries, and Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines have been, and Cambodia have been sort of at the top, and Laos have been sort of at the top of the list. But whether, China is going to need 1.3, 1.4 billion doses of vaccine at home also, and is it going to, just part with millions of vials of vaccine? Or is it going, and to provide to countries in Southeast Asia, or will it in the end, be willing to share early on, even if it doesn't have enough for at home? We really don't know the answer to that. So far, what China has promised is the pretty easy stuff. I would say the U.S. could have been a lot more generous in some of its comments also early on. But we had a president who was trumpeting America first, and so there hasn't been a lot of talk of cooperating on vaccines with the international community yet.
Do you think if the opportunity presented itself that the Chinese government would cooperate with an international community on something like vaccine development? Or is it there have been conversations raised about vaccine nationalism, not just from China, but also from countries like France, for example, with Sanofi? Is this a situation that we will see with China, or will they eventually perhaps take the opportunity to better their reputation on the international stage by cooperating?
That's really hard to guess. I do think they will certainly want to give their own population a major shot at the vaccine before they start distributing in the region, that's for sure. And it's going to take a while to produce all those vials of vaccines that are going to be needed. Is it going to need only one shot? Are you going to need two or three or boosters? We don't know yet. But even, you know, when you listen to countries that think they're going to have the vaccine soon, it really is going to take 9, 10, 12 months till we're going to see it distributed pretty widely in most countries.
There are those who also warn that all of the preoccupation with the pandemic, you know, as warranted as it is, may also give China the opportunity to reaffirm some of its hard power initiatives. So, for example, the Nine-Dash Line claim in the South China Sea.
Well, I have to say it bothered me a little bit to see them early this year in March begin to pressure some of the oil and gas exploration activities that Shell was doing off the coast of Sabah and Sarawak, that it was doing it off the coast of of southern Vietnam, when both these countries were struggling mightily to get COVID under control. They had it pretty much under control, but they, you know, chose to use a time when some people are down to whack them a little bit. That bothered me a little bit, actually.
It could be perceived that your comments are also coming from a kind of an anti-China standpoint. You know, what would you say to that?
Well, I don't consider myself to be anti-China. I guess I would have to confess, though, that I lived in Southeast Asia much longer than in China. So I'm a little bit of a Southeast Asia chauvinist, maybe. But I also grew up in Canada, where I know exactly what it's like to live next to a big elephant, right? If you live next to a big neighbor, you get bullied around a little. And so I guess I having lived in places like Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, I saw some of the things that China was doing, and it bothered me. And so I guess I'm not anti-China, but maybe I guess I'd say I'm pro-Southeast Asia.
All right. Well, I'm speaking with Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow, Southeast Asia's China Challenge. Up next, a closer look at other countries in Southeast Asia, including, of course, Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow, Southeast Asia's China Challenge. Now let's also turn our attention to Southeast Asia in particular. As a region, historically, we've not done very well in providing a balance against China, partly due to the very diverse nature of the countries involved. So in the wake of a global pandemic, and with the repositioning of major superpowers as well in the West, will Southeast Asia and ASEAN be able to bridge that gap, or will COVID only make divisions between these countries worse?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would, you know, one of the problems that I felt doing my research on how individual countries were responding to China was to see that every country was going its own way. Trying to have its own bilateral ties with China instead of cooperating with each other. I mean, if the countries in Southeast Asia had compared notes, they would, for example, find that that Malaysia on its East Coast Rail Link is paying a higher percentage of interest than is Laos, and China would charge Thailand if Thailand were to agree to a rail link. So far, they haven't. And I also thought that it was somewhat surprising that while China was pushing around a Shell off the coast of Malaysia and Rosneft, the Russian company, off the coast of Vietnam, they were actually pretty close. But they did not really compare notes what China's doing or try to cooperate. So that just opens the door to China just pushing countries around individually. And I thought that if countries could unite in pushing on the South China Sea, for example, or even, this is not an issue that affects Malaysia, but the Mekong River, where China's blocking of storing water behind its 11 dams in the upper reaches of the Mekong is causing drought in the countries of the lower Mekong, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. If the countries of ASEAN would stand up to China and say, this isn't acceptable, we have to find ways to cooperate on sharing water, I think China would be reluctant to have a number of countries in the region standing up to it. And so I would really recommend that ASEAN countries do cooperate more in their dealings with China rather than go individually.
I guess I always wonder what is the source of this difficulty in coming together to compare notes, as you say. Why is it that we haven't been able to come together and, you know, have Malaysia say, for example, this issue of the Mekong River is important to Thailand and Vietnam and Laos, even if it isn't necessarily of direct importance to us, and let us stand together as a region? Is it something to do with kind of a post-colonial, almost death grip on our individual sovereignty that is at play here?
That's certainly one thing that's at play. The other is that countries just are very focused on doing their own development, economic development, and don't want to get sidetracked, I think, by picking up other agenda items in their dealings with China and then having China get irritated at them about that. But the countries are also just so different. You have countries that are fairly democratic, like Indonesia, you have communist countries like Vietnam, you have rich countries like Singapore, you have poor countries like Myanmar. You know, their countries are, besides their colonial history, are just really radically different. Their ethnicity is different, their religions are different. And so it's not really necessarily natural, even though they have had a partnership, at least the original countries have had a partnership for 50 years. They might sleep in the same bed, but they have different dreams, that's for sure.
All right. And now, Marie, let's also focus in on Malaysia here while we're talking. And we're another country that has seen quite a lot of change over the past 2 years. Now, notably, the chapter in your book about Malaysia ends on the Mahathir administration. So if you had the chance to rewrite that chapter, taking into account the political shift we also had in February, what kind of issues would you highlight?
You know, in many ways, I would not say very much about the Mohyeddin administration, partially because on China and on superpowers and on neighbors, their relations are, their views of foreign policy and ties with China are very similar to what Mahathir's policies were, quite different than, let's say, Najib's policies. So I wouldn't have had to redo it in a major way. But the problem was that my final edits were due in January, and then Mahathir resigns at the end of, was it end of January? And then we soon have a new government. So I don't think I would change it radically just because this, and plus this government has been terribly focused on COVID, economic recovery, and should I say also just surviving, because its numbers in parliament are dangerously close.
Mahathir's administration did undergo quite a lot of shifts in terms of rhetoric when it comes to China over the course of its 2 years in government. Would you say that Tan Sri Muhyiddin's administration is more aligned to a late Mahathir sort of attitude towards China?
Right. The Mahathir that was in office just at the end. Of course, at the beginning, he was charging China with a new form of colonialism and going after Prime Minister Najib for, you know, alleged corruption under 1MDB and all that stuff. And that China was complicit in that by buying companies and paying too much for certain projects so that there'd be monies left over for helping pay back the servicing the debts of 1MDB. And maybe even to help with his re-election campaign. So but then at the end he did renegotiate the rail link, made it shorter and lowered the cost. And so he buried the hatchet, I think, with China. I think maybe somewhat anxious about where he was going to get the money from to complete the rail link if he did continue his sparring with them.
So considering many countries, ourselves included, will now have to effectively spend their way out of the economic slumps caused by the pandemic, should we be even more wary about potential debt traps from China, or would the Belt and Road Initiative be more of a boon than a bane at this point, in your opinion?
Yeah, that depends on the individual country and how they handle it. You know, we just had in September the first case of where Laos, which has taken a lot of credit from China on building dams on their high speed rail, on building special economic zones, that Laos had to basically turn over majority control over its electricity distribution company to a Chinese company, China Southern Power Grid. And I don't know if others are going to face this, but I really have to say I'm very frustrated that Laos agreed to do this. The IMF offered money. I think that I've heard that neighbors like Thailand and Vietnam were talking to Laos, but to turn it over to China is really, China got a black eye over taking over a port in Sri Lanka. And I really don't think that we want to continue down this road of turning over companies to China because we have too much debt to them. I don't think Malaysia is in trouble for that, but I think that it's going to be clear that the East Coast Rail Link, if the economy is moving slow, it's going to be a very long time till the East Coast Rail Link can actually cover its own costs and pay its debt.
So would you say then that China is presenting a new threat of colonialism as Tun Mahathir characterized it in his early days? Because, I mean, there have been concerns as well over the prominence of Huawei in the region and its, of course, ties to the Beijing government. Is there some kind of new colonialism at play here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wasn't ready to go that far, actually. I certainly in Laos, that really bothers me that China would give them so much credit that they couldn't service their debts. That is really a little bit disingenuous. It's like if a rich guy goes to a beggar's house and offers him money and say, you got to pay it back next week. You know, the guy can't pay it back. I think that's abusive. That's for sure. I don't think if you get into these relationships with eyes wide open, and I think Myanmar, which is very poor, also like Laos, has been very cautious about taking Chinese debt to the point of driving the Chinese nuts because none of the infrastructure is really being built. But maybe that's what you got to do, is play it really slow and cautious. I'm hoping that they're not going to get into, taking over a whole bunch of state-owned enterprises in Southeast Asia that are too far in debt. Indonesia is another example, though, where the government takes no sovereign debt, but gives it all to their state-owned enterprises. And some of them are really highly leveraged that are building the infrastructure. So it is a bit of a worry.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Murray. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Murray Hebert, author of the book Under Beijing's Shadow, Southeast Asia's China Challenge. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.